The New York Rangers upset the Lightning in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Final. It is the Canucks Hour here on Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host is Canucks insider Thomas Drance, who also covers the team at The Athletic. Canucks Hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery. Being a champion takes foresight. Build your company to win for years to come with fuel-efficient and reliable Kubota skid steers, excavators, and loaders from Avenue Machinery. AvenueMachinery.ca.
Do you know that every time we've ever done this show, when you say I'm Jamie Dodd, yes. I always have this impulse, like I always flip on my mic immediately and have this impulse to just jump in and be like, and I'm Thomas Drance! And just like jump the gun and introduce myself. I don't know what it is. It's like some weird Anchorman impulse that always rises, and it's not one of those normal, just like a thing I want to do. It's like it rises in my gut.
It's visceral.
Like, yeah, it's visceral. I just like turn on my mic and I'm like, this is the time I'm gonna do it.
No, anyway. Give in to the urge.
It's my job. It's my job to introduce you, Drancer. Don't crowd into my turf, man. All right?
I will not mow your lawn, but no. I want you to know how badly I would like to.
Well, you just wait your turn. Wait your turn, my friend. We got a lot of Canuck stuff to get into, actually, today. It is Canucks Hour.
Who, us?
Of course. Yes, I know.
We're going to talk Canucks.
We're going to go on a pretty big deep dive to the Canucks roster and specifically how
but
it
I've got
stacks
Celtic
up.
Stakes. I do, though.
Yeah, I don't know. Look, I don't want to get off on an NBA Finals tangent here, but I think... That is either going to be, I think we're going to learn a lot about that series in game one tonight. I think we're going to learn if it's going to be over really quickly or if it's going to be competitive.
Oh, I think it's going
to
be competitive.
My gut says the Warriors have a chance to put them away quickly, but I know there's a lot of smart people and smart models that really like the Celtics as well.
I've got Warriors in five and Warriors in six. I've sprinkled a bit on both because I think the odds are good there, but I think Warriors in six is more Oilers. Dreisaitl and McDavid are the new Splash Brothers, so... anyway, that's going to be fun. I'm going to watch that. I'm also going to watch Oilers and Avs tonight. It's going to be if you like scoring, tonight should be a good one in both the NBA and the NHL. There's a chance that the Oilers and the Avs have more goals scored than the Celtics hit threes.
That would be a good prop
bet.
If
the Celtics have one of those like 25% shooting nights, there's a real chance. Anyway,
we should talk to our friends at BCLC. Get that up. Novelty prop bet.
A novelty prop bet. Love it.
By the way, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The smart alternative. Visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver. Online at DunbarLumber.com. And we'll talk a little bit about game two between the Avs and the Oilers tonight. What happened at Madison Square Garden last night as well. But you know, one of the kind of all-time classic favorite, I don't know if it's a debate or just a conversation for hockey fans in a market that's been eliminated, right, and especially markets that didn't even make the playoffs to begin with, is, well, how does our team compare to the teams that are still playing, right? How do the Canucks stack up with the final four this year in the NHL, and what can these teams tell us about how far the Canucks or whatever team you're a fan of still has to go to make it to these heights? And as chance would have it, Drancer, you and your Athletic colleague Harmon Dial up at The Athletic today have a really, really interesting kind of deep dive piece on, you know, not just kind of the qualitative, but trying to quantify how the Canucks stack up with the four teams that are still playing in the NHL's conference finals. And we'll get into it. I'll give you a chance to kind of give your, you know, overview, big picture take on it. I will say, though, as much as you have the kind of well-earned reputation for being the, you know, the prince of pessimism here in the Vancouver hockey market.
Dr. Doom, yeah.
My takeaway.
The prince of pessimism, wow. I've never been called the prince of anything.
There you go. Congratulations. My kind of immediate takeaway from reading the article this morning was, I think I actually became a little bit more optimistic about where the Canucks stand and the path forward. Not to say that all of a sudden I think, oh, this is going to be a contender next year, but it definitely did more to kind of, as I said, make me more optimistic rather than the opposite reading the article today.
Well, there's three things in Vancouver we love to complain about, right? The weather, real estate, and the Vancouver Canucks.
Yes.
And I'm going to combine real estate and the Vancouver Canucks here in a quick analogy. The Canucks have good bones, right? This is not a roster, were it a house, that you'd come in and tear up the foundations of. And I think that matches what we've heard from Alvin and Rutherford, who have eschewed the use of the word rebuild. You know, you look at this roster and you've got a goaltender who very much compares with what the four teams still standing have. You've got a 1A defenseman who, you know, probably wasn't at the level. Well, probably wasn't at the level of a Hedman, Makar, Adam Fox this season. But you can see it.
It's not unthinkable that he would get to that level or have a season or two at that level in his career.
You don't have to squint very hard to imagine what it would look like for Hughes to level up and get there again, right? Maintain the defensive improvement he showed, improve the shot a little bit, right? Have a better defense partner, right? Because, I mean, you can't divorce that from it either, right? You can't divorce the team effect on an individual either. And you can get there. So there's something to work with there. Then you've got the model grades out three Canucks forwards as elite. Now, are they as elite as McDavid and McKinnon? No, but elite nonetheless.
But very few players are also.
Yeah, who is? Right.
If you're waiting to get one of those players before you think you're really going to be a contender, you could be waiting an awful long time before you really decide to hit go.
Top 10 percentile forwards. The model rates the Canucks out as having three of them, and it rates them as having five really good top six players overall. Well, most contenders have six, but, you know, you're not far from that. We know that the top six is a strength of this team. The model bears that out, and so at the very top of the Canucks lineup, you know, part of the story here is Canucks aren't far off at the very top end from being a pretty imposing team. I think that matches what we've seen over the last 3 years. I think that matches what we know about Pettersson, about JT Miller, about Bo Horvat, about Brock Besser, about Connor Garland. Like, there is a lot to work with here for incoming Canucks management at the very top end of the roster. Right?
Uh-huh.
There are also issues. And the issues in particular are in the middle of the forward ranks beneath the top six. Now, we organize the lineup based on the idea that, based on contracts in part, so we sort of put Miller and Pettersson together on a top line. We kind of reunited the lotto line for this exercise. Obviously, you could go and play them down the middle and have one of Bo Horvat or Elias Pettersson drop down and be your third line center. You know, that would help address your issues in terms of your deficiency, in terms of bottom six center quality, but it would open up a gap in your top six winger quality, right? And sort of create a situation where the Canucks actually need two top six caliber contributors up front. But that's neither here nor there. Let's not get bogged down in positional semantics. The fact is that in terms of their bottom six center quality, right? The Canucks have Juho Lamico and Jason Dickinson at the moment, and both grayed out by game score value added, the GSVA model that Dom Lecision uses to project future outcomes at The Athletic. It's the model that led, once again, all public models in log loss and outperformed the implied odds of Vegas. So for another consecutive season, the GSVA game score value added model, for as much as any detractors want to point to the Kraken or a miss or two here and there over the course of the season, this model outperformed Vegas, who has real skin in the game. That's a massive accomplishment. There's a good reason why we weight this model so heavily at The Athletic. It's predictive, it's proven, and he did it again, ladies and gentlemen. He did it again. He outperformed the market, although it got a little bit dicey. He had a real cold streak. The model had a real cold streak in midseason. It got a little dicey at around the 50 to 60 game mark. Anyway, Dickinson and Lamico grayed out as below replacement level. That's an issue. You sort of need bottom six centers to contribute in a meaningful way if you're going to play this late in the year. Look no further than JT Compher in Colorado. Look no further than Ryan McLeod and how he's stepped up for the Oilers. Look no further than Philip Hytl. My goodness, for the New York Rangers, driving things for them. Not to mention a guy like Cirelli, who's sort of drafted up the lineup, or the fact that the Tampa Bay Lightning are only here at this time of year, in part because they managed to wholesale replace a championship third line, a back-to-back championship third line, without taking too significant a dip in quality.
Well, and going out and getting a guy like Nick Paul, right, at the deadline,
and,
who's been
and
massive
Brandon Hagel
for them.
At huge expense, too, right? Not affordable additions for the Tampa Bay Lightning, but very, very good ones. And, yeah, I mean, replacing a third line that good without missing a step, I mean, that's why Julien Brisebois was incredible. And that's what separates the elite teams from the non-elite teams, is how well do you fill in the gaps affordably and within the constraints of the cap? And so that's an area that we know previous Canucks management continuously struggled with. It's why this team with good bones has not taken the strides that were expected, at least in part, over the last 2 years. Obviously, the budget constraints of the pandemic are also like a big subheader here that needs to be noted. So up front, you're looking at a team that probably needs another top six caliber winger.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some good bets internally for guys who could get to that level, particularly Vasily Podkolzin and Nils Höglander in the years ahead. So that's the good news. Middle six, you're really looking at a center. You really need another center who can do the job. And I think that's reflected on the penalty kill. It's reflected in JT Miller's minutes. It's reflected all over the place. Like, even if you think that they should go Miller, Horvat, Pettersson down the middle, you still want a guy who's first over the boards on every PK who's not JT Miller if you're going to re-sign JT Miller into his mid-30s and sort of lean on him to be a star player for you. You need to offset that burden. That becomes an even higher leverage spot to fill in the event that you're committing to this.
Well, and you would love to have the flexibility to have, okay, we can play Miller, Pettersson, Horvat down the middle if we want, but we can also load those guys up in the top six because we have this other really high-quality third-line center who can step in and do the job, rather than at times this year it felt like that was a move made out of necessity, right? And it's,
yeah.
Okay, hey, it's great that you have those guys, that you can do that, but you'd also love to be able to really juice your top six, having all of them in there if you can.
Not to mention that you're going to get injuries over the course of the year, and what happens, you know, when you lose a Bo Horvat or a Pettersson or a Miller for a 10-game stretch, particularly if you're a contender, like, what if you lose them like they lose Braden Point for the Tampa Bay Lightning? You know, do you have an elite team has the gear to win, right? If the New York Rangers lost Zibanejad, we'd be like, that's all she wrote. The Tampa Bay Lightning lose Point, and we're like, oh, they can still do this.
They can bring up Anthony Cirelli.
That's who you want to be. That's who you want to be. So that need stands out. And then overall bottom six upgrades are apparent, right? The way that Tyler Mott was able to drive a third line, you need to be able to find and develop and have a regular flow of guys coming in who, you know, maybe they're not all going to be Tyler Mott quality, but, you know, good players in that spot. In terms of Vancouver's bottom six guys, other than the two young players, right, Höglander and Podkolzin, who the club drafted themselves in 2019, you know, I like Matthew Highmore. I really like the season Matthew Highmore had. I think he can be part of the solution, particularly given his stylistic fit. But you're still looking at needing an awful lot more in that bottom six milieu for the Canucks. And that brings us to the defense. And the defense is a far greater issue.
And just to run through everything, we kind of highlighted it forward there based on like the analysis
and,
you
and
did.
And go check my Twitter feed because I did surface the graphic that we're basing this conversation off of. Outside the paywall, so if you go visit twitter.com/ThomasDrance, you can see the GSVA comparison stacked side by side to give you a sense of exactly what we're running through, and obviously go subscribe to The Athletic and read.
And just to run it through, it's kind of another top six winger, a really capable third line center, and maybe a fourth line center as well, but the highlight there is a third line center, and then just general depth in the bottom six.
Yeah, and quality depth.
Quality depth. You run through those, and I don't want to say any of those pieces are easy to find by any stretch of the imagination, right? But those are also kind of classical solvable problems in the NHL. Like, there's a lot of teams that are in that spot where it's like, man, we need to go find a good top six winger. And you can do that. You have to use some resources. You might have to take a bet, but you can do that. There are ways to solve those problems.
You have to be able to do it affordably.
Yeah.
Like, all good teams are able to go out and find those guys. I mean, go look at again, the four teams, because the whole exercise is comparing to these four teams, right? Right now, the New York Rangers in their top six have two guys acquired for mid-round picks. Well, one guy required for a real mid-round pick, like a third-round pick, in their top six right now, in Frank Vatrano, right? That's a perfect fit for them. He's given them a fantastic dimension, volume shooter, really effective player. He's done excellent work for them in the playoffs, a good kid, too. That's been the type of ad that a good team can pull off at relatively low cost. Go look at the Colorado Avalanche, and yeah, they paid a lot for Arturi Lehkonen, but that was still a guy brought in at the deadline. Another fixture in their top six, Valeri Nichushkin, was signed on a trial one-year deal, basically, 3 years ago. That was a complete rebuild project. You don't need Evander Kane added at midseason for the Oilers. That's a different type of gamble, but nonetheless, a gamble, low cost, done on the fly over the course of the season. you know, all of these teams have a guy like that, a story like that, a guy they took a shot on who has provided major dividends. Look through every elite team in the league and you'll find a Michael Bunting. You'll find a Carter Verhaeghe. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You'll find a guy making a big difference who wasn't necessarily expected to.
Yeah, who you didn't use premium assets either in terms of like a first round pick or a ton of cap space to acquire in the first place, right? You found them on a less costful, less costly route to getting that player.
Although we do also have to discuss the possibility that the Canucks move players out from their top six here, in which case that would sort of create a vacuum, a larger set of considerations which the club would need to replace, right? If you trade JT Miller, like the problem with trading JT Miller is A, you can only do it once, and B, you no longer employ JT Miller, who's an elite piece, and now you got to
find another elite piece.
And now you're looking at replacing the guy, and that ain't easy. So,
but anyways, my point was that the problems at forward, and I'm not trying to downplay them or make them sound like, oh, you just wave your magic wand and replace them, but they're kind of typical problems that NHL teams find a way to solve. You know what I mean?
Like, there's well-run ones do.
Yeah, well-run teams can tackle those problems, right?
Although maybe not all at once.
Sure.
It might be an 18-month process,
sure,
but we're not talking about a four-year scorched earth. You know, I don't know why whenever I say anything critical about the team, but sometimes I get these mentions that are like, you're right, tear it all down. And it's like, no, that's not what I'm saying.
don't do that.
We've endured enough pain.
Well, this exercise is kind of like, should put that argument to bed. You have more than enough pieces here that tearing it down shouldn't be a consideration.
Tearing
it down is waving the white flag when you have way too many good pieces already here.
When you have a bunch of top picks that have hit and are still in their mid to early to mid 20s, you know, and Horvat counts here, Pedersen counts here, Besser counts here, you know, Garland's only 26, maybe just turned 27, but he's in that age range.
If anything, he just turned 26, yeah.
Yeah, Quinn Hughes, Thatcher Demko, right? I mean, when you have those pieces, you need to be able to find a way to surround them, as complicated as it will be for a team that has for too long ignored the prospect system and committed too much too much money, all told, almost across the board. Which brings us to the defense.
Yes.
Speaking of too much money committed for too long, the defense. This is where the Canucks, for me, are really facing a more existential crisis, a more existential roster construction issue that they're going to have to navigate with extreme delicacy. So, Hughes is, at the moment, an elite 1A defenseman, but he's not quite at the level of the Norris candidates. I don't think that's breaking news. But I'll tell you this, Quinn Hughes is going to get there. There's the zero down in my mind. You know, that's the type of person, the type of player you bet on every time.
And another way I have to frame this question, right? Because, yeah, he's not at Victor Hedman's level. No kidding. He's not at Cale Makar's level. No kidding. Cale Makar had one of the best offensive seasons we've seen in decades for an NHL defenseman. But another way I think of it is, can you win a Stanley Cup with Quinn Hughes as your best defenseman? And for me, the answer is yes.
Categorically,
right? Yes. So, okay, boom, check. You've got a check right there next to Quinn Hughes' name.
The model, however, only rates the Canucks as having one additional top four defenseman, top four caliber defenseman. That's Oliver Ekman-Larsson, who had an impressive bounce back in his age 30 season. Beyond that, it gets a little dicey. Now, what's interesting is the Canucks have sort of already grafted some decent defensive depth onto their lineup. The Luke Shen signing has worked. Kyle Burrows was an effective contributor for this team this season. Travis Dermott, it grades out by the model as an above replacement level third pair guy. If they bring back Brad Hunt, or if Jack Rathbone emerges, you know, you're sitting pretty decently in terms of your depth defenseman. But in terms of having two more top four quality D, that's going to be a struggle, right? The model does not rate Tyler Myers as being at that level. The model does not rate Tucker Pullman as being at that level. And that's counting on Pullman's return to full health and full availability next season. Plus, you know, him playing at a level that he's never played at to this point in his career. That's intractable, right? Particularly because the model basically rates $8.5 million in the Canucks committed cap space for next season and the year after. And in Pullman's case and the year beyond, just $2.5 million. On a pair of guys who are not top four level. That makes this really tough to navigate, particularly because they're also paying elite defense money to both Myers and Oliver Ekman-Larsson, right? Mm-hmm. So significant inefficiencies. In fact, going into this offseason, I checked it on Cap Friendly last night. If you go sort it, you won't quite see the positional breakdown the way that I'm about to lay it out, but that's because Cap Friendly has Tucker Pullman still on LTI. Once his deal is factored in, and the other teams in similar situations with LTI contracts are also accounted for, the only teams with more cap space committed to their defense corps going into this offseason are Vegas. Makes sense. Shea yep. Theodore, Alex Pietrangelo, pretty good. Even though they
Alex Martinez
down the stretch. Yep.
Yep.
Vegas, San Jose, not so good.
Not ideal.
Really bad. And there's one other, and the name escapes. You know what? It's Boston because of
okay.
the Hampus Lindholm deal.
Of the Hampus Lindholm
also
extension.
Not very good.
Yeah.
That is a problem. The Boston's blue line's a problem. So you are at this point where you've got a defense corps that is expensive and committed with, you know, too much money is committed to it and for too long. And the needs are through the roof. It is two top four caliber contributors to play along. That's not something you can fix in one summer, particularly given Vancouver's cap situation going into this offseason. That's going to be a multi-year project. And that's where the gap, like that's where the pessimism kind of sets in, is the blue line is so far from being good enough. GSVA thinks it. I think it. I think common sense indicates it. And this is even with Oliver Ekman-Larsson having a stunning bounce-back season, Quinn Hughes refinding his rookie season form and then some as a defensive contributor, having a tremendous year, Luke Shen playing the best hockey of his career for Vancouver, and Tyler Myers having the best season he's ever had in a Canucks uniform. Like, all of that happened and is accounted for in this, and still the gap between them and the contending teams on the blue line is just mammoth.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to kind of highlight the difference between where the forwards stand and where the blue line stands, just in terms of how relatively simple it is to solve the respective problems in each area, right? And at forward, as I said, not easy, but very doable. Very doable things that smart organizations find a way to tackle. You've got a bunch of guys who are kind of slotted in the right roles, right, that you think you can win with, and then you need to add pieces around them. You need to find quality, you know, I don't want to say necessarily bargain hunting, but find cheaper ways to add quality around a really, really good core up front. On the back end, you know, I made the point, can you win a Stanley Cup with Quinn Hughes as your best defenseman? Yes. But then you go down the list. Okay, can you win a Stanley Cup with Oliver Ekman-Larsson on this contract as your second best defenseman? That becomes a much trickier question, right?
And also, he compares to the top four defensemen on contenders, but as the fourth guy.
Yeah.
Not as the second guy or the third guy, but as the fourth guy by GSVA. I'm not saying that he can't be better than that next year or whatever. It's not, this isn't fate. I'm saying how the model rates him is as, you know, Oliver Ekman-Larsson is at the level of the fourth best guy on a contending team. Hughes is at the level below that of the best defenseman on a contending team, but you can see him getting there realistically on a really great team right now. You'd probably want him to be a two.
Yeah.
Which leaves you needing A, better contributions from your already elite defenseman, a number two guy, and a number three guy. That's really hard. That's going to take years of effort and work and an awful lot of luck,
and
too.
That's still, then you have your number four guy, OEL, making a ton of money, right?
Right.
Making more than you want your number four guy to make. And it's that kind of gap, the gap between Quinn Hughes, and then you get down to Travis Dermott and Luke Shen, and you like those. Okay, those are good contributions, right? Those are guys that are on the money they're making and the roles that they might play. You feel pretty good about, but it's the gap in between Quinn Hughes and then down at the bottom end of the defense, those two, three, four positions. Those are hard to fill at the best of times, right? Like, just going and finding a top four defenseman who fits with your needs and can do all the things you want him to
and
do.
And is available
and
doesn't
is available,
cost $8 million.
It's really, really difficult.
Really hard.
And then you get into the considerations of, oh, and they're also paying these guys for years to come, right?
Well,
like, the combination of all three of those factors makes it really, really difficult to tackle.
Well, and the only way to do it, realistically, the only way you're going to do it is if you're able to go out and bet on some guys before they're at that level, right? That's the Travis Dermott example is sort of the lowest end rung of that type of deal, but it's got to go further than that, right? It's got to be, you know, another guy with sort of higher pedigree, younger, who you're able to get. And, you know, that's, I think, why you're hearing so much about the Canucks, and you're not hearing it as much now as you were during the season, but I think that's why we're hearing so much about the Canucks gauging value on some of their top six forwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you address a catastrophic weakness in the organization? Well, you trade from an area
deal
of relative surplus.
Yep.
And, you know, that the logic of that becomes even more firm when you consider that Besser's expiring this summer, right? Then the next year, you've got Horvat, Miller, and Hoglander. All will need raises and probably some significant ones, right? Very significant ones in Miller and Horvat's case. And then the next year, you've got Pettersson up. That could be a really significant raise if Pettersson plays the way he did in the second half.
You certainly hope it's a significant raise.
Yeah, you're
right. Better than the alternative.
In fact, the logic of you being as good as you are, or you want to
be a raise.
It requires Pettersson to be at the level where you're like,
or
really
else we're
sweating
it. Or else we're having a very different. If he's coming in at the same price or just a little above, then you've got bigger problems.
You're dead in the water if the question is like, oh, $8.8 million qualifying offer for Pettersson, that's dicey. Then you're really hooped. Right, you want the thing to be like, how can they get that done? And then obviously Pod Colson too, and that's going to be a very interesting second contract as well. Hoglander, I mean, if Hoglander has a big year this year, you're going to be talking about a guy who has like, what, 150 points on his ELC? Like, that becomes dicey. That becomes expensive. So these are going to be very, very interesting times for the Canucks. Can they even afford? Like, one of the big questions is, even if you are team optimism about this team, under Boudreau, they will cruise into the playoffs. They showed it in the last 57 games. Even if you're on that train, right? Full belief in what this group is. Even then, it's going to be very tough just to keep this group together. And that sort of adds to the complication and the stakes of what Rutherford and Nelvin will be navigating this offseason as they try and close the gap between where they're at today and where the team's still standing are.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Get your thoughts in. I want to chat a little bit about, so we kind of laid out where the Canucks stand in relation to the final four teams this year, and I want to chat a little bit about some of the avenues that the team can use to try to improve and close those gaps and address those needs coming up this summer. Get your thoughts as well about what you want to see the Canucks do, where they need to really improve to get to the level of the conference finalists this year. Again, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Don't forget also to subscribe to the Canucks Hour podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please do leave us a 5-star rating and review as well. And also, a little bit of breaking news as concerns 650 here, but in approximately 2 hours at 1:30 on The People Show with Bick Nizar and Randeep Janda, Henrik Sedin, newly assigned to the Canucks Player Development Department, will join the show. And of course, former captain, one of the greatest players, if not the greatest player in franchise history, Henrik Sedin, will join the show. So make sure you tune in for that as well. Lots more coming up on the other side. It is the Canucks Hour on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to the show. It is Canucks Hour here on Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. I'm Jamie Dodd.
I'm Tom Stress.
There you go.
I'm Tom Stress.
There you go.
I'm here.
I gave you some space for it that time. I feel on the second, in the beginning of the second segment, I will permit you to come in and do your own introduction.
Oh, thank you.
But stay
thank
away,
you kindly.
Stay away from the top of the show. That's my territory.
I'm deeply appreciative.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Some really good thoughts coming in. We were talking on the other side. We'll continue to talk here about how the Canucks stack up, both kind of from the eye test, but also quantitatively with the final four teams still playing in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Of course, the Tampa Bay Lightning, New York Rangers, Edmonton Oilers, Colorado Avalanche. Lots more I want to get into on that. This thought came in from Brandon in Vancouver, who says, hey guys, what about goaltending? Demko is amazing. Martin has looked amazing in a small sample size, but what is the depth from there? There will be injuries. A third string goalie will possibly need to play over the stretch of a long season. Who do we think that will slash should be, especially since I think we all agree there needs to be less dependence on Demko playing so many games? And yeah, we didn't really spend much time on the goalie side of things. I think partly because
Demko's
awesome.
Demko's a franchise goalie.
Yeah, Demko's a franchise goalie.
Demko is not out of place with the goaltenders. In fact, you'd probably rank him in the middle of the four goalies remaining.
Yep.
Right? In the middle. And considering the guys you'd rank ahead of him are Shesterkin and Vasilevsky.
That's easy choice for top two goalies in the world.
Yeah,
right?
Well, and Vasilevsky emerging in the conversation with guys like Waugh and Brodeur and Hasek. You know, I mean, forget Vasilevsky being in the conversation for best goalie in the world. He's emerging in the conversation for best goalies of all time. And that's, you know, neither here nor there. So we didn't spend a lot of time talking about goaltending because the Canucks have it. The Canucks have it. Now, the third goalie question is a really interesting one because there's certainly some industry skepticism about the Canucks' appetite to go into next season with DiPietro and Silovs both down in Abbotsford.
Mm-hmm.
Silovs has clearly emerged as the apple of, you know, Vancouver's goalie development system. He's the apple of the eye of the Canucks goalie development system, which is really a one-man department, as Ian Clark. DiPietro's development has stalled, and I don't know that you'd blame the player. The organization has made a hash of that, to be totally honest with you, and that's not on Clark either. That's partly on, well, most of the, I'd put the lion's share of that on resource issues, particularly during the 2021 season that saw him really waste away. It was a wasted year. This season, he didn't progress perhaps the way you'd have hoped, but how much do you pin that on a young guy who didn't really get to play? He basically lost 18 months of his career.
Yeah.
He's still a highly regarded prospect. Does he need a change of scenery? I expect the organization will at least look at bringing in a veteran goaltender regardless, but the DiPietro situation, this isn't the first time I've said it, I'm not reporting anything new, you know, is one to monitor because certainly people around the industry are, right? There's a sense that there could be something there, and we'll see where it goes. It's just too bad because there's not a lot of kids you'll meet in this business that are as hardworking, as high character as DiPietro. He's an enormously talented, enormously athletic goaltender. He doesn't have prototypical size, but his, you know, east-west movement is lightning fast. His competitiveness is through the roof.
And I'd also just say, and this is partly from a media perspective, but I think for fans too, anytime you hear him interviewed, and he's been on the station many times, but anytime you hear him interviewed, the personality just shines through. Very easy guy to root for. All the things you're talking about, the competitiveness and
all
of that.
It all shines through, yeah.
You hear it right away, and you're like, oh yeah, this guy gets it.
He's going to succeed one way or another. You know, hopefully for the Canucks, it's here, but I think there's some doubt about his future going into this summer, particularly as a result of Martin's emergence and surpassing him on the depth chart, Silov's emergence as the organization's, you know, as a highly touted organizational goaltending prospect. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see where this all goes. But I do expect that the Canucks will strongly consider a veteran, you know, third goaltender to play in Abbotsford and to be that third guy that a team could have. You know, I always sort of look through. Now that the Canucks have the Abbotsford Canucks in town, I always sort of look through and put a little check mark in pencil beside players who are from the area. And there's a lot of reasons for this. One is that, you know, everyone likes to play at home.
Sure.
Like, it's great. Be around family. The other is, though, is that if you're an AHL player, right, even if you're on a high two-way deal, you're making $400,000, $500,000 a year because you're an established sort of American League vet. $500,000 in Utica, New York, lets you live really well. $500,000 in Vancouver, as we all know, or even in the Fraser Valley, you're renting. You're renting, you know? It's a very different set of considerations. And so typically, you know, I think you have an advantage pitching goaltenders who are familiar with the area, who know Vancouver well. And you know, one name that sort of stands out to me among the available unrestricted free agents this summer that I'll be curious to see if the Canucks actually do consider would be White Rock's Michael Hutchinson.
Yep.
That's sort of the guy who stands out to me. Again, not reporting anything. This is me favoring guys with local connections who are available. Did I say Michael Hutchinson? I meant Andrew Hammond.
That was the guy who jumped to my mind for me as well.
Sorry, I don't know why I messed that up. You know why I messed that up? Because they've both been Avs' third goalies thrust into the playoffs in recent seasons. So I just slipped over it. They also, yeah, anyway. Andrew Hammond, the Hamburglar, is the guy that sort of stands out to me among the list of available options. And we'll see where it goes. Be very interested to see exactly how the Canucks approach that one.
Something to keep an eye on for sure, no doubt about that. Now, okay, when you're talking about the Canucks offseason and where they stand and how they need to improve, You know where we're going, Drance. It all eventually comes back to JT Miller. And the subject of JT Miller, should you extend him? Should you trade him? What is the best thing for the Canucks to do? And I have been very much on the wisest course of action, assuming that there's no, you know, extraordinarily team-friendly deal to be reached with JT Miller, which I would not expect there to be. If that's not the case, then you probably have to bite the bullet and explore your trade options for JT Miller. And I thought it was really interesting reading your piece with Harmon Dial at The Athletic, because it kind of makes the argument in both ways, not explicitly, but just the information presented. Because if you want to look at it and say, you know, the metrics you're using grade JT Miller as the Canucks' best forward, the Canucks' best skater, by a pretty significant margin. And if you want to turn around and say, well, hold on a second, if we're talking about good bones and how the forward group is a strength of this team, if you turn around and trade JT Miller, all of a sudden, aren't you kind of cutting out at the knees the one strength of this team? And I say, yeah, well, there's something to that. But you also look at the scale of problems elsewhere that they need to change, and you start to kind of work through, okay, we talked about it, how difficult it's going to be to address what they need to add on defense, given the contracts, given all of that, given the lack of prospects, and you just start to kind of tease out how can they start to get a handle on all of those things. And you keep coming back to, well, if you got a really massive return for JT Miller, that could go a long way to helping you address a lot of those problems.
If not the next season, then over the next 18 months. And, you know, it's just so complicated, right? It's so hard because of, and I don't mean to sound like a guy having a bad trip, but it's all connected. You know, it's all connected. And for the Canucks, you're in this moment, this really delicate moment, where you've got a fair bit of talent on the NHL roster, particularly in your top six forward group, and yet you're not a playoff team, right? You have significant work to do to close the gap between you and the NHL's elite. Even if you think this is a true talent playoff team based on what you saw in the second half, well, again, I'm not even going to argue that, because that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about how this team's structurally positioned. So even if you believe this is a true talent playoff team based on what we saw in the second half, you'd have to accept that there's still a gap between them and the elite teams in the NHL, I think. I think we can all agree on
that.
Now, so you have some talent at the NHL level. However, you don't have cost certainty with that talent. And that's a big difference between how the Canucks are positioned versus, for example, how the Avs were positioned when they bottomed out, you know, in 2017 and 2018, and then were able to rebuild quickly. They had McKinnon locked up for sure on this, you know, 5-6 year deal that he's still on, right? Florida's quick turnaround was driven in part by Huberto and Barkov and Ekblad all being on these locked in below market deals. Like, Barkov spent this season at 5.9 and Huberto at under 6 million too. And Huberto's under 6 million again next season. Well, that creates the window. The Canucks don't have that cost certainty up front, right? So you're looking at this situation where everyone's about to get more expensive, and as everyone gets more expensive, what do contending teams typically have to do?
Go bargain hunting, right?
But more than that. What did the Tampa Bay Lightning have to do with JT
players.
Miller?
Yeah, they have to trade JT Miller because there's things that you can't fit everyone under the cap.
You have to jettison guys.
Yeah.
So, like, I know it's hard to hear this because this team hasn't had a ton of success, but just from a cap positioning and strategic positioning standpoint, we're talking about a team with a bunch of supporting players or a bunch of core players, all of whom are about to get more expensive all at once. A team that's traded a ton of draft pick capital in an effort to juke the quality of what they have at the NHL level, and as a result, doesn't have a reliable source of cheap labor coming. And a team that's got a lot of money committed to aging pieces, you know, at all areas of their roster, right? I mean, you think about Pearson, you think about Ekman-Larsson, go down the list. Well, what does that sound like? Honestly, the Canucks are positioned like an end-of-window contender for just from a cap perspective, except that they never contended in order to build this. And, I mean, how do you navigate that while also believing and trying to support in the near term the elite core of talent that you do have that's mid-20s or younger? It's going to be an enormously difficult task. And just like the contender tier of teams that we've seen, you know, among the Final Four, the teams that are still playing, it tends to necessitate losing pieces. It means Barkley Gaudreau goes elsewhere for the Tampa Bay Lightning, right? It means that you lose Gord and Coleman and JT Miller, right? I mean, they've had a huge outflow of really good players.
Yeah, extraordinarily talented players.
Extraordinarily talented players. The Colorado Avalanche are going to deal with that for the first time in their sort of window this offseason when Kadri and Nichushkin become enormously expensive. And then the next year, you've got MacKinnon coming up, right? So they're going to begin to hit that moment in their team building cycle. The Canucks are hitting it really not now, like not right now, because they do have some cap flexibility. It's easy to run this team back if you want to. In fact, it's easy to run this team back with a tweak
or two.
With a tweak or two, just cap-wise. But next season and the season beyond, you are going to face some enormously difficult decisions. And so the question becomes, is it proactive to accept that even if we run it back, we're not elite? So the time to take a step back is now to accelerate the moment when we're back on the come up. For me, it's a relatively simple yes. That's you have to do it. It's too bad. It's too bad. Like, I'm not saying, I take no joy in declaring this. Like, because the Canucks aren't good enough to really justify continuing to push chips into the middle of the table, in my view. Because what they'd be after is getting to 98 points and a first-round playoff berth, in my view. Just based on their true talent level. I think you need to nip it in the bud and begin to do the work that was avoided for too long to shore up the fundamentals of this organization. Cap flexibility, draft picks, like future assets, and obviously bolstering your prospect pipeline. Because without those things, you just don't have the optionality, like the options you need to improve rapidly when you get to that moment, that sort of tipping point moment where you can go all in, where you can make even New York Rangers style tweaks, like the Mott Vetrano Kopp deals. Like, the Canucks don't even have that type of arsenal of picks to do that without setting them back for years and years to come. The Rangers were able to do that without breaking a sweat because of the work that they did since the letter in 2018 to sort of, you know, draft, develop, reset where they were at fundamentally. That to me is sort of analogous to where the Canucks are at. And it's an unfortunate spot to be, just considering how little this team has actually achieved, particularly, you know, in the season since the bubble, but also overall over the past decade.
The Miller thing feels like I keep looking for an alternate solution, or like I've made an, it almost like you're adding up like a family budget or something, and then you get the result and you're like, wait, hold on a second, that can't be right. Let me look at these numbers again. And they're like, oh no, it is right. That is the best path forward. I don't want it to be. It would be awesome for the Canucks to keep employing JT Miller. He's a fantastic player. But I just can't kind of escape that logic every time I come back to it, as much as I might want the answer to be something else. The other player I wanted to touch on, and I know we mentioned it earlier this week, and especially if the, as you said, if the Tampa Bay Lightning do go on to three-peat as Stanley Cup champions, that might be a boon to Tyler Myers' trade value, because he's, you know, obviously has the size, and Tampa is the kind of the team remaining that still trades on size on the back end to get things done.
Well, the Rangers do too.
Yeah, that's fair.
So the Eastern Conference Final, you've got a couple of behemoth defense scores. And honestly, I would say Cody Ceci's playoff success, probably pretty good for Tyler Myers too.
Sure.
You know, I don't think the Oilers are wilting violets back there, right? I mean, you've not that the Avs are, just that you've got CeCe, you've got Darnell Nurse, who's obviously sort of the big ticket item there. You've got Bouchard, who's very much in the Myers mold, 3 inches shorter, but nonetheless big, more offensive than defensive, despite his size, right? Like, there's a real analog there for me. You know, and then even the Avs, for all that I like to talk about them being this team built around a fast puck moving defense corps,
they still have Jack Johnson and
They still signed Jack Johnson and brought in Josh Manson at the deadline. Yeah. So they addressed that specific part of their team. So a pretty interesting dynamic on the blue line. Look, I think Tyler Myers will be at max value a summer from now. I've said that repeatedly, but I also do think that with the way he performed this year, with the amount of minutes he logged, you know, with the way the NHL is still trending and how much size is still prized, for sure he'd have a ton of value. But I don't think that's not that that's not something the Canucks would consider so much as I do think there's a fair bit of regard for him as a person and player internally too. So it's not something I'm expecting to be a top of mind consideration.
I understand the regard. I also just, and look, maybe you keep your powder dry because as you said, the value is higher next summer, even at the deadline, right? Where it's like the playoff run and then one more year beyond that. I could see that. I just wonder, because of the money you have committed on the blue line, if you're getting in a scenario where a team gets really interested in Tyler Myers and all of a sudden that value spikes, I do wonder if, as much as it would leave a really, really significant hole in your blue line and you're already trying to add talent there, and I get that, that's really tricky. I do wonder if you have to kind of start to consider that as much as you might not want to just because of his contract and because of the other problems you have there. Jay in Calgary texts in, I don't know if I'm the only one who thinks that the Canucks will need to trade more than JT Miller. I don't really get how they could actually build a contender without having a more extended rebuild. And I don't know about in terms of an extended rebuild, and I don't want to get into the semantics of, oh, it's a rebuild, it's a retool, a reset, or whatever. It's trying to add talent and making your team better, however you can do it. But I think there's something to the idea that, yeah, it's not as if a JT Miller trade, as much as I've been a proponent for it, it's not as if that's a panacea. And all of a sudden, you know, the assets and the salary cap space you get as a result of a JT Miller trade help you remake the team overnight. Yeah, there could be some really difficult decisions. I mean, I just brought up Tyler Myers, but there certainly could be other candidates that they explore moving as well, Drancer, as we get into the summer here.
Absolutely. I mean, Rutherford is known for his aggression. I think Patrick Alvin is setting the plan in motion here. You make no mistake, the Canucks believe in this blue line group perhaps more than I do. Well, definitely more than I do. But make no mistake, the priority is going to be to try and find a couple of guys who they can project down the line as being stud defenders. That was their priority at the deadline when they were gauging the market value on everybody, and the chatter around this organization heated up to, you know, a dizzying extent. That's going to be the priority this summer. We'll see. At the end of the day, those are very hard players to acquire, even if they're not quite at the level that you're dreaming on when you make the deal. I'm very curious to see exactly how they go about doing it. There's a lot of talent in Vancouver in terms of their forward ranks. There's going to be a big market for a lot of those guys. And, you know, the Canucks might have to be flexible. If the goal is to go for broke and bring in a couple of young blue chip defenders who you hope develop into top four horses for this organization, you might have to be, it might not be like, well, we want to trade this guy for sure because another team might want X other guy.
Right.
And if you're really committed to getting that done, you may need to be willing to go to plan B, plan C. And it's going to be an interesting one to see exactly how they navigate it, particularly because this is a new era. This is a new management group. We haven't seen them do a ton yet. And yet this feels like an absolute inflection point off season for an organization that definitely needs to chart a new direction.
I'm still expecting headlines, fireworks at some point in the offseason. It's difficult for me to imagine a scenario where that doesn't happen.
Although,
right?
Although, don't you feel like we're Homer Simpson watching the gang fight out front and he's like, you know, Jim Rutherford's
yes.
just standing there. It's like, but he hasn't done anything
he's
yet.
He's going to do something really cool.
It's
going to
be
it.
Awesome.
Yeah. But that guy does do something really cool eventually. Homer just doesn't see it.
I know, for sure.
I think we'll get to see it.
I think we'll get to see it too. But that was the deadline. Like, I closed the door
yes,
at the deadline
yes.
and I was like, aw.
All right. Well, we will end on that point for today. We will be back tomorrow to wrap up the week. Enjoy the game tonight. Don't forget Henrik Sedin at 1:30 on the People's Show with Bick Nizar and Randeep Janda. You've got it on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.